Well, I'm trying to reach anyone and everyone, obviously, but my book aims to explain to the world, as I've explained to myself through reading and writing and understanding, that actually the planet isn't getting worse. It's getting better in most respects. In particular, the standard of living of people all around the globe, despite rises in population, despite pressures on natural resources and things like that, has been improving at an extraordinary rate over my lifetime. And I've amazed myself by looking up the numbers. People are living a third longer than they were when I was born, all over the globe, not just in my country.
When we see people starving in Africa, for example, it's difficult for people to believe the figures, is it?
That's right. I mean, there is a lot of misery, poverty, starvation, hunger, malnutrition, disease around. And it's a terrible thing, and we should work very hard to find ways to reduce it. And my book is very much not saying the world is fine. It's quite the reverse. It's saying because there's still so much suffering around, actually, we should be aware of just how much we can improve the world and how it is actually possible not to conclude that Africa is finished and that there's no hope for it, but quite the reverse, to say, look what we've achieved in the last 50 years. Do that again in the next 50 years, and we could actually see Africans having the living standards of some Europeans within 50 years. Now, that's, you know, that's an amazing thought, but it's actually what it's the trajectory we're on in terms, you know, things like food per head. There's roughly 30% more food per head in the world now than there was 50 years ago, and yet the population has more than doubled.
Is it as well distributed, or is it better or worse distributed?
Well, on the whole, global inequality in terms of income has been falling. It's been falling steadily and relatively rapidly. It's even falling in Africa at the moment. Now, you and I know that in some Western countries, income inequality has been rising, although not necessarily consumption inequality. And so we tend to think, oh dear, the world's getting more unequal. But actually, it's the poor who've been getting richer faster than the rich who've been getting richer. And as a result, global inequality has been falling. For example, the fastest growing country in the world over the last 40 years is Botswana.
But there are still a lot of people in Africa living on less than a dollar a day, aren't there?
There are indeed. It's hard to know exactly how many. But Africa is where the problem of poverty is now most concentrated. That's not to understate the problems in countries like Afghanistan and Haiti and Bolivia and wherever else. But it is to emphasize that Africa is, as it were, the real challenge for optimists, as it were, to try and improve the world in this century. And I genuinely believe it can be done. I mean, we're seeing African growth rates. They've been extraordinarily high for the last 10 years. You know, Africa had a terrible 1980s and terrible 1990s, but it has turned around. And all you need do is get people the opportunity, the infrastructure, the investment to exchange and specialize amongst each other. That's really the story of human progress. And they will do it in Africa as well. Africa's brimming with entrepreneurialism. You've only got to walk into a slum in Nairobi and see that, as it were. So my book is not saying everything's fine, but it is saying there is hope that things can get better.
But Africa is also the continent where the deserts have spread furthest, and desertification is one major problem. Are you optimistic about that as well?
Yes, look at the Sahel. The Sahel is hugely greener than it was 40 years ago. When I, in the 1970s, when I was writing first about this, the desert was said to be advancing by a mile a year or whatever it was, or a mile a day, I can't remember.
This is countries like Chad and...
Chad and Niger and the Sahel, Upper Volta and all other Sahel countries. But now, if you can go and look, you can look it up. You can see the greening of the Sahel. There has been an increase in rainfall in that part of the world. There have been a number of projects, like ones that are basically planting trees and things in parts of the Sahel, that have had a dramatic difference. But on the whole, it's mainly a climate thing. There's been a general greening of the Sahel. The desert has not advanced. It has actually retreated in the last 30 years as far as the southern border of the Sahara goes. And by the way, we're learning fascinating things about the history of climate in Africa recently, which is that on the whole, Africa has suffered during ice ages from what are known as mega droughts. The level of Lake Malawi dropped 600 meters during the last ice age, and it became saline. And huge parts of the continent were inhospitable and uninhabitable in those days. Then, when we came out of the ice age, we had this very warm, damp period known as the Holocene Optimum, when there were hippopotamuses in the middle of the Sahara. Then, as it cooled after that to the present relatively cool period, the little ice age that we're just coming out of now, it got drier again. But, you know, it tends to be that when it's warmer, Africa is wetter and more hospitable.
That leads us fairly naturally to the question of global warming. Is it happening? Is it human-caused? And do you believe that it's as serious as many people think?
The answer to those questions is yes, yes, and no. In other words, it is happening. We are on a rising temperature trend at the moment. It isn't yet to unprecedented levels or happening at unprecedented rates. It seems to be no different in scale or speed from other warmings that we've seen in the 1930s, in the turn of the last century, and indeed, of course, in the ice cores from much longer ago. Mankind is undoubtedly having an effect on climate. We're changing the reflectivity of the land by cutting down forests and things like that. And, of course, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas and is trapping warming. And that should produce about a degree of warming over the century, which would be relatively mild and, on the whole, slightly beneficial. It would slightly increase crop yields across the world. The question that people disagree about is whether that 1 degree of carbon dioxide-induced warming would produce 2 more degrees of water vapor-induced warming, which is essentially what the IPCC argues. I'm increasingly convinced that the empirical and theoretical evidence doesn't support that view, and that on the whole, clouds will more likely slow or mitigate the carbon dioxide warming rather than exaggerate it.
Here in Australia, particularly in southeastern Australia, we've had a very, very long drought recently, which is only partially cleared, and scientists are saying that the climate has changed quite radically. Nobody can say it absolutely conclusively, but what do you think?
Well, I don't know the situation in southeast Australia well enough to presume to comment on it. I'm aware of the droughts you're speaking of. They have happened before. They will happen again. It is, if the world is warming a little bit, which is what I said it is doing, then you would expect climate zones to shift slightly south in Australia. And I believe that northern Australia is getting slightly wetter, just as southern Australia is getting slightly drier at the moment. But these are, you know, it's very hard to pull a global climate signature out of a local weather pattern, as it were, of a few decades long, which is why, as you say, nobody's quite sure exactly what's happening. But, you know, there is absolutely no doubt, if you look at the models, that the number of people in the world at increased water stress as a result of the predicted climate change — I'm not talking about the climate change that I think is going to happen, it's the climate change that the IPCC says is going to happen — the number of people at increased water stress in the next 85 years is going to be less than the number of people at decreased water stress. You know, that comes from peer-reviewed articles written by IPCC scientists. And so, I think
it's going to be small comfort for the people whose dams are drying up in large cities, though, isn't it?
It's going to be good comfort for people who are finding increased water supplies. Climate always has changed, always will change. The evidence suggests that we are actually going to see higher crop yields, slightly higher rainfall, no major change in storms, no significant change in a very slow change in sea level, no huge damage to habitats. Now, I may be wrong. There is an outside chance of a tipping point where a catastrophe happens. My point is that if you look at the evidence carefully, the probability of that is low. The probability that actually things will be better for most people in this century is high.
Even though the population is 6 billion and rising.
Yes, we are about 6.7 billion at the moment. The rate of increase of population has halved in my lifetime. It's come down from about over 2% in the 1960s to just over 1% now. That means we're adding fewer and fewer people to the planet every day. If that continues, and the evidence is that fall has accelerated rather than decreased in recent years, it's falling even in Africa, the rate of population growth is, then by mid-century, the UN estimates, we will have 9.2, maybe 9.3 billion people when the population peaks in about 2060. Now, one of the interesting features of that is it means that in the 21st century, the population of the world will have increased by 1.5 times. It quadrupled in the 20th century, and it doubled in the 19th century. So the population, as it were, we have to cope with, the population increase we have to cope with, is less in this century than in past centuries, both in absolute numbers and in the rate of increase.
But we already are worrying about resources, aren't we, just to keep the 6.7 billion going. For instance, what about peak oil?
Well, we can talk about peak oil in a second, but just on food quickly, because that's the one most people worry about with respect to population. We are actually feeding, we're producing nearly 3 times as much cereals from the same acreage as we did 50 years ago. If we increase yields at that rate again for another 50 years, and all the evidence suggests we can, because there are huge areas of the world that are not getting fertilizers and pesticides and new varieties and things like that yet. If we do that, then we can feed 9 billion people from a much smaller acreage, a significantly smaller acreage, than we are currently using to feed 6.7 billion. That means that this will be a century of ecological restoration, a century in which we can actually return land to wilderness on a grand scale. I think that's a wonderfully ambitious goal to aim for, and it's something that, you know, you're beginning to see it happening already with forests being replanted in a number of parts of the world.
But to come to peak oil,
yeah.
I mean, every night on our television screens at the moment, we're seeing a catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico, which appears to be caused by deep water drilling. In other words, drilling for more and more oil because it's getting harder to drill in the easy places. That's because of peak oil, isn't it?
Well, it depends what you mean by peak oil. I mean, the Gulf of Mexico catastrophe is indeed a terrible environmental disaster. Although it's worth noting that the amount of oil spilled, even including this latest spill, is down about 80 or 90% on what was being spilled annually in the 1970s. So we are learning lessons from that. There was a deep Gulf of Mexico rig that caused a far bigger spill in the 1970s. That's no comfort to anyone, but it does imply that it's not, you know, this kind of deep water technology, which we should be learning to do more safely, clearly, is not necessarily being driven by anything sort of dramatic happening in oil supplies today. I mean, at the same time as people are drilling in deeper water, they've also discovered a way of getting gas out of shale in North America, and they're now trying it in Europe. And that has supplied us with centuries worth of extremely cheap and available gas. And gas is, on the whole, got very few environmental problems. It's got half the carbon emissions of coal. It can't spill like oil. It doesn't take up transport space, et cetera, et cetera. It can be piped across country, you know. And so, you know, there's good news and there's bad news. And there will continue to be disasters and bad news, and we have to learn from every one of them. But there are centuries worth of gas, as I say. There is many centuries worth of coal. There's no question about that. A lot of it's quite deep, but we can probably, we're getting ways of getting at it deeper. And as for oil, it's all a matter of price. There are huge reserves in places like Canada and Venezuela and indeed Australia, which are available at a high price and which, if necessary, will come on stream. I suspect, though, that fossil fuels will become obsolete long before they go extinct. In other words, in 50, 60 years' time, we'll find that some new form of nuclear or maybe improved solar will then be so cheap that we'll stop pursuing fossil fuels to anything like the same extent because we won't need them, and there'll still be reserves left.
In the meantime, one thing we haven't spoken about is extinctions. We appear to be entering an era of mass extinction, according to many environmental scientists, and we're already seeing some species right on the edge or gone. Can you be optimistic about that?
Well, I can, because the rate at which mammals and birds have been going extinct, and, you know, it's hard to know if that's representative, but it's the one area where we've got enough descriptive data to compare, has actually been falling for 100 years. It seems to have peaked, the rate of extinction seems to have peaked around 1900. And that's because a lot of that extinction was caused by the introduction of exotic species to islands like New Zealand or Hawaii or places where, you know, native species went extinct in competition with exotics. And that's been the major cause of a lot of these extinctions, is exotics moving around the world. And it's still happening, but to a much lesser extent.
But another big cause is deforestation as humanity expands. I mean, look at the orangutans in Indonesia, for example.
Absolutely. And look what's driving the pressure on orangutans in Indonesia. It's biofuels. It's the program of trying to produce energy from fuel, from palm oil, instead of from fossil fuels, because of worries about climate change. This is one of the things that I'm worried about climate change policies, is that we're actually rushing into some really crazy policies that are doing real damage to the environment. In effect, we may end up discovering that what we've done is tried to stop a nosebleed by putting a tourniquet around our neck, that we've done more damage with the mitigation than we were doing with the policy. So, for example, you know, the best way to save the orangutan is to stop subsidizing biofuels.
A lot of people are aware of the anti-Nestle campaign in Indonesia. I think fewer people would be aware of the palm oil being used for biofuel.
I don't know about the anti-Nestle campaign, but it's absolutely clear and has been published in, you know, journals like Nature and so on, that one of the problems with large parts of Indonesia is the planting of palm oil plantations for biofuel.
In general, though, deforestation is a massive problem. I mean, not only because of biofuel, isn't it?
Deforestation is a massive problem, and if you look at what prevents it, intensification of agricultural yields is the single best policy we have of preventing it. At the moment, we're feeding 6.8 billion people from a particular area of land. If we were using the average yields of the 1950s, before most people got hold of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, then we would need 82% instead of 38% of the continent's land area to feed the human race. That would leave absolutely no room for rainforest. So the more we can intensify agricultural yields, the less pressure there is on rainforest. That's abundantly clear from the data of the last few years. So, you know, although I like organic food and some of my friends grow organic food, I object when they say that it's good for the planet. I don't think it is. I think it's on the whole a selfish thing to do, to grow organic food.
And let's talk about the sort of central organizing ideas behind everything you say, namely your long study of, I suppose, human society and genetics, and your idea that the more people there are together, the more they cooperate and create new things.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to do is to understand why human beings had this extraordinary explosion after 45,000 years, because 45,000 years ago, because before that we were just a common predatory ape that lived its life, had a big brain and used tools and things like that, but did not do anything extraordinary. And then suddenly we reached this point where technology accelerated, where human numbers accelerated, and where we changed our ways of living very rapidly. And before we knew where we are, we had cities and toothpaste and Google and things like that. And so what's explaining that? And my argument is that it's not really, you know, consciousness or language or any of these things that people have concentrated on, some genetic switch thrown in the human brain. It was something that happened between brains rather than within brains. Because what's peculiar about the human species is that we work for each other. Each of us produces one specialized thing, we call it a job, and consumes lots of diverse things, we call it consumption. And to the extent that we're self-sufficient and have to make our own living standard, we're not very good at it, and we call that poverty, because that's what subsistence means.
This is a level and above the chimps, for instance, teaching each other how to use a sharpened stick.
Well, that's right. Culture, you know, a lot of other animals have it like chimps. In other words, teaching each other how to use a sharpened stick. We had that. What changed was that we started swapping things and thoughts with each other, and eventually were able to do that between strangers, between tribes who were would previously have been enemies of each other and so on. In a sense, we invented trade. And the huge advantage of trade is that you do what you're good at and I do what we're good at, and we swap, and we're both better off for the exchange. And that the spread of that process is basically the story of human prosperity. Now, it keeps getting set back by wars, famines, population explosions, dictators who don't like to let this kind of thing go on. They like to plunder it rather than encourage it, etc., etc. But nonetheless, it has continued to, in a remarkably inexorable way, and it continues today. I mean, we're living through a terrible recession at the moment, and you know, in the Western world, there are people losing jobs and all sorts of things.
But in a way, you're saying that globalization is actually programmed into the human genome.
It's programmed into the human genome is kind of the wrong way of looking at it, I think, because I think what happened 100,000 years ago was not some genetic switch was thrown, but some gradual change in our nature whereby we had got more and more interested in working for each other. And by the way, the earliest example of working for each other is male hunters working for female gatherers and vice versa. That's a very peculiar human habit that seems to be universal. Maybe that's what pre-prepared us for this. But when that happened, intelligence went collective. We were no longer limited by the size of the human brain, because I'm holding a pencil. This pencil was made for me by millions of people, and nobody knew how to make it. Literally nobody on the planet knows how to make a pencil. Not the president of the pencil company. He only knows how to run a company, and so on. Do you see what I mean? And so the result is that we have this extraordinary collective intelligence whereby the information as to how to run society is stored all across society and is not limited by the size of our brains. And that happened as a form of cultural evolution, not as a form of genetic evolution. It's all happened much too quickly for our genes to really catch up.
And because we have been so creative in the past, you think that we will be able to think our way out of whatever problems come along?
Well, that's right. There is a degree of extrapolationism in my argument. In other words, if we have pulled off these extraordinary achievements for 200 years, then we can probably pull off some more in the next 50 or 100 years. You might think that's naive, but actually what I've done is I've gone back and looked at what everybody said over the last 200 years, and everybody said, all the intelligentsia always said at every point, right back to 1800, well, things have been fine up until now, but they're about to go wrong. We're at a turning point. And there's a wonderful quote from Lord Macaulay in 1830 where he says, with so much improvement behind us, why are we to expect only deterioration before us? And he was lamenting at the sort of dirge of pessimism he was hearing all around us. 1830 was the time when Britain's living standards started taking off in a big way.
Have you got a theory as to why people are pessimistic even when they might be optimistic?
This is one of the ones that baffles me. I don't have a great theory for that. Clearly, there's a huge incentive to be pessimistic in the sense that no news is good news. Good news is no news as far as the media is concerned, as far as funding agencies is concerned, as far as government agencies are concerned, that on the whole, you're much more likely to be listened to if you cry imminent alarm. But I'm not sure that's a satisfactory explanation, because it seems to be a deeper psychological thing than that. And maybe there's something from evolutionary psychology here, that way back in the distant past, if you and I were met on the path to the waterhole and you said, I shouldn't go that way if I were you, I think there's a lion behind the rock. And I replied, oh, well, I'm sure everything will be fine, don't worry. then I was dead and you weren't. So maybe there's been a selection for pessimism in the human race.